Picture yourself having to lie still for an hour in a recovery room. You're wearing a hospital gown with only a thin blanket. You're shivering a bit, and the only sound you hear is a slight buzzing of the lights and the dull whir of the air ducts overhead. You look around the stark white room and see a picture of an iceberg. Comforting, you think sarcastically. Can the environment around you help you heal? Experts say yes. This stark recovery room decorated with an iceberg photo is a true story. But medical facilities are changing their habits and embracing the arts. I'm Kara Hetland, and over the next hour, we'll explore the healing arts in South Dakota. The art in the art of healing is the music drifting through a hospital while you're waiting for the results of a biopsy.
When you're in a tough situation, that really can speak to you.
The art is also a shared experience through the words of a poet.
By putting it into words, if somebody reads those words and it helps them, then I've really done my job.
From music to poetry to the pictures hanging on the wall to the building design itself, experts and artists say art heals. The doors to the main entrance of the Cheyenne River Hospital in Eagle Butte open and close repeatedly. Doctors, nurses, patients, and visitors bustle in and out. But Jim Yellowhawk is standing still. He's looking up where a large circular atrium looms. On it are painted four huge horses. A warrior is riding on each one.
Above on top, I have stars represent the ancestors.
And monarch butterflies are scattered among the galloping warriors.
Be red for north, and then yellow east, white south, west black. So all the directions are in this piece.
Yellowhawk says this mural is the biggest piece he's ever undertaken. He painted it to honor his wife, who died of cancer in 2010, about 6 months before he began the project.
Myself, I'm here in the south direction with the geese, but when Ruth passed away, all these butterflies came. And right above her is Gabe, my son. He has a red shield. He was telling me after Ruth passed that all these monarchs attached to him. So it was good to carry all of us in this piece.
Yellowhawk says there is a star representing his wife, Ruth, in the mural. He also says she was with him as he painted.
When I was working on the last piece, that last star, Ruth's voice came up, and she was doing an interview.
Ruth worked in radio for several years. She completed many interviews while she was alive. Some of them played on his iPod as he worked.
When we have a chance to really not only exhibit our creativity, but even experience another person's creativity, it just naturally has the potential to heal our spirit, heal our place.
Yellowhawk says Ruth's words ring true. Creating the hospital mural was an important part of his grieving process. He hopes it now helps others who enter the hospital find healing too.
And what's awesome, you know, that I can do this and share this mural, you know, with the people. It's like a high honor, you know, for me to do that, to do something you feel you done something good for you, for the people.
Jim Yellowhawk shares his art not only in South Dakota. He built a one-man show titled Healing Art. He most recently took the show to New Zealand. He gave lectures on the art of healing and performed traditional Lakota dances. We're hearing a recording of him dancing now. All of the pieces in the Yellowhawk Healing Art Show are inspired by his wife Ruth and his grieving process. For those like Yellowhawk, both experiencing art and creating it can aid in healing. Art is in itself a therapy. Some compare the process of creating art to the feeling you get when you step off a roller coaster, that moment when you actually feel calm. For expressive therapists like Jesse Park, making art gives people in helpless situations a little more control.
The best quoted phrase, and I don't know whoever said it, but it can heal when there is no cure.
Park is also the coordinator of the Sanford Arts Program. She has staff members do art projects in the lobby of the Cancer Center. Mickey Scheibe stumbled on it when she was there for an appointment.
I'm drawn to art. I like art and creative things. And so we picked up a brochure.
Scheibe was diagnosed with breast cancer in January and just finished her last chemotherapy. She sits on a couch in her living room wearing a baseball cap. Her hair is just starting to grow back. During her months of treatment, Scheibe spent time painting, and her kids, ages 8, 12, and 15, also worked on art projects.
I just think it helped them to be where I was and to be doing something while they were there. It was therapeutic.
The art created by her kids and friends decorates their Huron home.
That picture the kids did, you can see a semi. And there's a tractor, and there's some farm equipment. I think there's a combine on there, too. And it's lightning.
Also on display is a painting created for Scheibe. There are red peonies and green grass with a large butterfly and different smaller insects painted by her husband and children. The words scripted on each painting are written by Mickey Scheibe.
Cancer is so limited, it cannot stop me. It cannot take away my personality. It cannot steal my laugh. It cannot wreck my family ties. It cannot take away my friends. It cannot take away my faith. It cannot stop me.
While she's nearing the end of her treatment and on the road to recovery, Scheibe says she's not sure what she's going to do with the painting.
Honestly, I don't want to be reminded for the rest of my life that I had cancer, so it won't be a permanent fixture.
Mickey Scheibe is still weak from her treatments. She says all she really can do is paint. She shows a new painting of what she calls a sunset. There are white clouds and different shades of red. Her husband, Todd, sees it more as abstract.
He's making fun of it.
Abstract.
For her, painting is an escape.
When I paint or do some craft, that's just what I'm doing. I'm just doing that, and I don't really pay attention to what else is going on around me. And no matter what the stress is that you're going through at that time or whatever you're worried about, it helps.
Mickey Scheibe isn't alone in looking forward to doing art while receiving medication.
Can I come in? Is it okay?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Okay.
So I'm Maria.
Hi, Maria. I'm Kara Hetland.
While touring the Avera Prairie Center, Maria is sitting in a reclining chair covered with a blanket, and tubes are connected to her chemotherapy port. A tray filled with art supplies sits close to her chair.
Down here where it's green, we're going to put a little bit of purple so it looks like wildflowers down here.
She's putting some finishing touches on a square tile she's creating with Denise, who is an artist in residence. They're creating flowers by dropping layers of ink and paint and leaving room for an inspirational saying.
And you know, I'm not that artistic. I do needlepoint on plastic canvas, so this is really cool.
It's like an art party in here today because we have a lot going on right now. We've got, we were making jewelry in the room next door, and we're just finishing that up. Oh, I love this.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
Yep.
That's gonna be
so this is, and then we've got this beautiful saying here.
Read it to me.
Let us be grateful to people who make us happy. They are the charming gardeners who make our souls blossom. So that's what we're putting on our tiles with flowers today. And then these will have little frames that you can set them on. So.
Do you already have a spot picked out where you're going to put
it? Oh,
yours?
Yeah, it's in my bedroom. So I can see it from my bed when I wake up at night.
So you're not here for treatment, you're just here for art.
I'm just here for art, and the treatment comes separate. You know, it's like, okay, that's the secondary reason I'm here. I'm here for the art first.
Maria is a retired teacher, and she and Denise worked in the same elementary school. She says it helps that she is reconnecting with an old friend while having regular chemotherapy. You're listening to a special report called The Art of Healing. I'm Kara Hetland. While creating art is therapeutic, experiencing it is also healing. Studies show patients who are surrounded by appropriate art heal faster and require less pain medication. We'll take a look now at how artists create images for places of healing and how buildings are being designed differently to have an impact. Artist Mary Groth has paintings hanging in several hospitals and medical clinics around the region. She believes art is healing.
What touches us in that place and moves us is going to make us better.
Groth says art can draw people into something bigger than what they are, and that's calming.
That lets your body heal. It lets your body rest. I mean, that's one small aspect of healing through the arts.
Healing is not just about the art on the wall. It's also about the environment around us. Ivy Oland is an art consultant.
I do believe that there's more in the world around us that impacts how we feel or the state of our health.
It's her job to help architects and hospital administrators incorporate art in all new building projects.
Facilities, the structure, the walls, have the ability, when designed appropriately, to positively impact outcomes.
Take the Avera Behavioral Health Building in Sioux Falls. Steve Lindquist is the Assistant Vice President for Behavioral Health Services at Avera.
This building was built as a statement building to make a statement to society at large, our region as well, about behavioral health disorders are health conditions that need to be treated in a respectful way.
Lindquist says if a neighbor goes to the Heart Hospital, we send cards and flowers and even make a meal. But when someone goes to behavioral health, we are silent.
Let me just lay of the land. This is the public area.
There aren't any sharp edges in the public areas of this building. Everything is curved, and there's a large two-story wall with windows giving a glimpse into the locked corridor that leads to private patient rooms. Art and banners are everywhere.
All of these are original commissioned pieces of art, probably about 25 altogether.
And the blues and plums and greens are calming colors.
But the earth tones, for the most part, are what we have throughout the building.
Lindquist says the Benedictine and Presentation Sisters developed a theme Bible verse for the building based on Psalm 139.
There's a certain verse in there that says, if I rise on the wings of the dawn, you'll be with me. And so that rise on the wings of the dawn phrase became really the element that was conveyed into our artwork.
Doves, birds, kites, butterflies are depicted in all original artwork. Steve Lindquist believes the building itself is healing. He tells a story about the first day patients arrived. Some were transported from the Avera McKinnon campus. One man, angry about being moved,
said, I'm going to rip that place up.
But instead, staff found him calm and quiet in his room.
And the gentleman was sitting on his bed, and he actually was somewhat teary-eyed and said, are you okay? And the gentleman said, I've never been in a place so nice. He didn't rip the place up, obviously, and he had a good stay, a successful stay. And that's the kind of power that a building like this can have.
Lindquist says the building captures the desire to help each human being that enters it.
They're getting a sense of what we think about them in terms of who they are as human beings. And that's really what we wanted to capture, is the importance of each individual human being who is here. And we're helping them through a rough time, and we want to do that extraordinarily well.
That same feeling of caring can be felt across Sioux Falls at the new Sanford Heart Hospital. Chris Denovan is the Director of Facilities and Planning for Sanford Medical Center.
We're trying to evoke a feeling of history, strength, tradition, trust, to make it look like it's been here a long time, and it will be for another 100 years.
Gone are the square, sterile box buildings with small windows. The new Sanford look is of dark wood and cast iron fixtures.
Not just new, modern, shiny glass, square.
Denovan says in the early design phase of each heart hospital, they asked what patients needed most.
And the one thing they said to us was, I don't know if I remember much about my stay here. I just wanted to get home, and I wanted to see your hospital in my rearview mirror. So we've kept hearing over and over, they slept better at home, they ate better at home, they wanted to get home.
Art consultant Ivy Oland used this information during the interior design phase of the Heart Hospital.
We tasked artists with going into 20 to 25 of the communities that most of the patients are coming from and painting a landmark building or landmark structure in their hometowns. And so people were just delighted, you know, as they have to go through that journey of traveling to Sioux Falls to discover that the Canby Theater was painted somewhere within the walls of the Sioux Falls Sanford Heart Hospital, or, you know, the Mitchell Corn Palace, or any of these communities that they're coming from. They felt that they had a little piece of home.
30 artists created 120 pieces of art that are also used in rehabilitation. The canvases are spread down the hallway, urging patients to walk to the next town's image.
It wasn't pictures of people running marathons. It was, you know, paintings of local parks in Sioux Falls that people could go take a walk in. Or, you know, a montage of imagery of a woman walking down the dock to the lake. Very simple things, but things we may sometimes take for granted that these patients are really considering.
Oland says while much care and thought of art and placement are put into new construction projects, they are removing art in the old spaces where it could cause harm. When most people think of art, they might think of a painting on the wall or a piece of music, but art can also mean writing. Words are an inspiration and also a sense of healing for those who write and those who read. When we come back, we'll explore writing as a means to heal. I'm Kara Hetland, and you're listening to The Art of Healing on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. In this segment, we'll explore how writing can heal. We'll start with this poem by Christine Stewart.
Confession. Sister, you didn't know I pretended to snore in my strawberry shortcake sleeping bag as you yelled at Mom across the room. She hissed, "Why do you do this to me?" You couldn't see yourself stumbling up the sidewalk in your nurse's uniform, bottle in hand. You reached for me. I turned away. Beer lessens stress, you said. Whenever you made Mom cry, I bit my lip, wished the worst. How could I have known when I woke to your unmade bed and crossed myself to make the prayer official? As the hum of your car's engine pulled Mom to the garage door, as I wished for you to die, you already had. And that there's a prompt in a book that said, write your deepest secret. And this is, again, an example of healing and the way art, my theory, this example is an example of it. So I wrote down that I prayed my sister to die. I prayed for her to die.
Christine Stewart is an associate professor of English at South Dakota State University. She has several published works of poetry, including the compilation book, Keeping Them Alive.
Keeping Them Alive, it braids two narratives, one of my sister's death and one of my son's birth, and they're in opposite directions. So the narrative of my sister's death starts out with her death, and then goes backward in time, kind of goes backward in how I'm remembering that and in mourning that. And then the other narrative, it starts out with conception and you don't see the baby born until, you know, towards the end of the book. And I did that on purpose to kind of create a tension in the narrative arc of the book.
Stewart's sister died in 1984. Her body was found in her car parked in the garage with the engine running. Christine Stewart says she has written many poems and essays and short stories about her own personal experiences as a way to grieve, to heal, and to honor her losses. She has had several miscarriages, and writing about the birth of her son helped her.
Actually, one of the poems in Keeping Them Alive, Spot, was one of the, it's a threatened miscarriage. When I was pregnant with my son, I spotted and I thought that I was going to have a miscarriage, and that's what that poem is about. And I thought that only women would really get that poem, and one of my friends who is a writer and happens to be a man said that was my favorite poem in that book because it really persuaded me to feel something that I would never been able to feel before and get into the mind of someone who is scared by that. So I can read that. Spot. 234 periods trained me to feel my cyclical shift, to count down before I welcomed the warm mark. Sometimes it's soft ache, inconvenient. Sometimes a Thanksgiving. I never thought its absence a safe sign, never added days of lack for peace of mind, until 10 weeks pregnant, a spot, blush of terror. What color, asked the hotline nurse, like wine, like Christmas, lighter, almost pink? I decided, like bricks. Then relax, a cramp, read your body, a book advised. Every 5 minutes, I slid down my underwear to gauge betrayal's shade. So that one was threatened. That wasn't real. So that, but I wanted that moment. I wanted to capture that moment of feeling, that complicated feeling of what's happening and is this what I think it could be.
But it was.
It wasn't that time. It wasn't that time. Interestingly, and I think that's what's kind of strange about my life is that pregnancy was perfect, except for that moment. You know, and then I had four others that I lost.
Stewart acknowledges the topics of death and miscarriage might be uncomfortable to some. She writes for not only herself to heal, but also for others who read her words to find comfort and to know they're not alone.
A lot of art is generated from places of healing and moments of healing, and that writing in particular is important to healing processes for a lot of people because it's the first chance someone gets to narrate their own story of whatever trauma or whatever experience caused them pain or caused them suffering. And that is one of the most important things for me, is to be able to name and narrate my own stories of pain and suffering.
Stewart says having that act of narration witnessed by someone else is therapeutic. Her son is now 7 years old and at the age of 4 was diagnosed with a rare form of epilepsy.
His Landau-Kleffner syndrome, his expressive and his receptive language skills are impacted by this. And so he experiences the world as if everyone's speaking a foreign language and he understands bits and pieces of it.
She says she's not able to write poetry about her son's condition. Instead, she's writing essays as a way to cope.
For me, although I'm still in it, so I really can't say it's healed. But it gives me metaphors and ways to describe him to other people. It gives me a language. It gives me a lot of time to reflect and think of the right language and the right narrative.
Stewart says journaling about her son is not art. But she says in a few years, she may be able to go back and hone her words into art.
Writing is a small sort of act towards immortality.
Patrick Hicks is a writer in residence at Augustana College.
We naturally gravitate towards words to heal us. I mean, words can heal us. And I think that we don't value words as much as we should.
Hicks held a series of workshops at the VA hospital in Sioux Falls. The idea was to help veterans returning from war heal through writing. But instead of young men and women returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, he was surprised to find the writers turned out to be Vietnam veterans.
Because I was at times a fly on the wall when they were talking about what it was like to come home. And I remember very vividly in one of the sessions that I did a few weeks ago that I just said nothing as they all talked about coming home and what that experience was like, especially at that point in time in our nation's history. And it was, you could tell that the wounds are still there. And although it happened many decades ago, it didn't, not in that room. It happened just yesterday.
Hicks says for that group, writing doesn't have to be about their experiences in war.
As a writing coach, if you will, is to just help other people see the stories that they're living every day. But everyone thinks that their lives are not interesting to other people. Well, I don't believe that for a second. I think that we all lead these incredible lives. And I think it's just how you tell the story will make the story interesting or not interesting. So often I feel like my job is to try to find the core of what makes that person interesting and then help them sort of nudge them along to shine a spotlight on that.
One veteran stood out in Hicks' spotlight. But before Kip Sorley would agree to a taped interview, a few promises were made, like not talking about his time in Vietnam. Sorley is a published cowboy poet. He's won numerous awards for his writing, but he is shy and humble and quick to give credit to others. He doesn't like crowds or stop signs.
Or streetlights, and I prefer being rural. I get nervous when I get around cities.
He has shaggy brown hair dusted with gray lining the underside of his cowboy hat. His mustache grows past his mouth and hides his teeth. Sorley wears Wrangler jeans and a Western shirt. His hands are worn with hard work and experiences, but his eyes sparkle with kindness.
And I started late trying to be a rancher. You know, I was 40 years old when I started doing that, and I should have grown up doing it. You know, it would have helped.
Instead, Kip Sorley grew up on Drummond Island in northern Lake Huron. He traveled to the mainland in Michigan to attend school. He served 2.5 years in Vietnam and then started his ranch at the base of the Cabinet Mountains in western Montana, where he says he made a lot of mistakes at first.
We had a small head of Hereford cattle, which went through a really bad winter, and I lost all my calves. And I don't like losing calves.
Remember that line, he doesn't like losing calves. When asked to read a cowboy poem, the conversation shifts and his pledge to avoid talking about Vietnam is broken.
I like to be called a cowboy poet, but I do veteran poetry. And it's probably more special to me than being considered a cowboy. You know, at best I'm a half a cowboy, but I'm all a veteran.
He takes out a sheet of paper from his satchel and shares a poem that describes a place in western South Dakota that's special to him, the Black Hills National Cemetery. He wrote this poem sitting in a park across the highway.
It's called Exit 34. The Black Hills monuments are known across our land, but not too far away are other stones that stand. Near its northern border, the treed Black Hills descend into rolling grassland. Its gentle slopes extend. Too few who travel by will visit or explore the markers on the lawn at Exit 34. The rows and rows of stones stand proudly to defend the honor of the spirits lost to both kin and friend. In green grass or in snow, they sparkle in the sun. They speak of wars long fought and some that were not won. The kin they left behind and old friends bound by war know of last full measures at Exit 34. Upon that rolling lawn for everyone to see stand some of the reasons that each of us is free. Those rows of monuments pay tribute to our dead. As you pass, give homage, or maybe stop instead. Sacrifice a moment to those who've given more. The gates are always open at Exit 34. It's a real special place.
Kip Sorley has several poems about Vietnam hidden in his satchel. Not many people have seen them. He's given some to the VA hospital to use with discretion when somebody needs to know they're not alone in how they feel.
I'm not a group person. I have to do it. It's got to be personal. And by putting it into words, if somebody reads those words and it helps them, then I've really done my job.
Sorley says by putting his war experience on paper, it helps him release the weight he's carried around for years.
I've never let out. I mean, even my wife didn't even know I was in the service for almost 20 years.
Kip Sorley says he started writing poems for veterans when he realized he wasn't the only one hurting. He was diagnosed with diabetes and spent time at the VA hospital in Montana.
I met a whole bunch of other veterans that had run away and moved to Montana and live up in the mountains, and who felt the same kind of thoughts that I felt. And it was the first time in my life that I felt that there were other people that felt the same way I did.
Sorley is writing a poem for his family to read after he's gone. It's about 60 pages so far.
It's probably not any good, but it's honest.
He writes all of his poetry longhand with a pen and pad of paper. He says sometimes it takes 100 revisions before he considers it done. Sorley says writing and rhyming words heals his scars.
The scars will still always be there, but I think they won't bleed as much.
Writing about the truth helps him understand and accept his past. Today, he's a cowboy poet, and years ago, he was a soldier.
I think veterans and cowboys have a lot in common.
He just happens to have a poem that combines the two. It's called Calves and Friends. Remember the line earlier that he doesn't like losing calves?
With pencil in his hand, the cowboy sat and thought. Of calves he'd catch and brand, end of a war still fought. But there appeared no word describing now or then. Of bawling calves he heard, of dead and dying men. A cauterizing brand will leave a scar behind, not like the ones unplanned that fester in his mind. The scenes seared into his mind are sharp and clear inside, but words he wants lined are words not wrote. They're cried. Spring calves that he finds dead are like the friends he lost, and words are best unsaid that can't convey the cost. His inept pencil's curse he knows will not be cured, and lifeless calves make worse the dreams of war endured. He camps on open range, both miles and years from then. It is a fair exchange for words he cannot pen. His pencil holds a flood of words he will not write, of burning flesh and blood, of friends he sees at night. He does not rant or rave. He holds the hurt within, and calves he cannot save remind him where he's been. If he could just set free the million words not penned, perhaps, if that could be, his dreams would find an end.
Kip Sorley reading his poem, Calves and Friends. I'm Kara Hetland, and you're listening to The Art of Healing on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. In this segment, we'll look at how music can heal and meet a professional musician who relies on his love of music as he and his wife face a difficult time. As As we discuss the role art plays in healing, we would be remiss to not discuss the parallels between medical science and art. I'm Kara Hetland. According to Sioux Falls neurologist Dr. Jerome Freeman, healing itself is an art.
There's a huge amount of science in medicine, but to combine that with a human touch, with empathy, with understanding, with careful listening is very important. The art of medicine.
Freeman has written a book on kindness. Bringing Kindness to Medicine is a book of short essays that examine various circumstances in healthcare that exhibit and illustrate kindness or the lack of.
People are so grateful if we're kind to them. And there's a lot of emphasis in medical school right now about professionalism, about empathy and integrity.
Freeman says while kindness helps a person heal, so do art and writing and music. He says healing itself is different for each individual case.
Much of healing involves understanding of one's condition, sometimes acceptance of it, and really, ideally, a decision how to go forward.
Dr. Freeman says healing doesn't always mean you're cured.
Hi, I'm Susan Hill.
Susan Hill was 33 years old when she was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was newly engaged, and instead of a year focusing only on wedding plans, she instead chose flowers and invitations between chemotherapy and radiation treatments.
So we kept the same wedding date, 1 week after my last radiation treatment.
It's now 5 years later, and the cancer is back.
It's stage four now. It's breast cancer that has spread to my liver, lungs, adrenal gland, and spleen. And I'm stable. The medicine they have me on is working, and we'll ride that wave as long as we possibly can. Unfortunately, stage four is not curable, but it is treatable. So that's what we're doing. We're treating it.
Susan has long blonde hair. Her eyes sparkle when she laughs. Her husband, Christopher Hill, says her laughter is music to his ears. Chris Hill is the principal clarinetist with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. He has performed several times with the Music is Healing program in the lobbies of various health facilities. But he realized when he was with Susan at her treatments just how powerful that music can be.
When you're in a tough situation, that really can speak to you.
Waiting for test results or meetings with doctors is a stressful time, says Susan.
And to hear someone either playing the piano or singing or playing some type of instrument, and just for a moment, it's a release, and it just brings you to a more happy place, and more, it's more calming, and you know, even if it's just for a split second, to get your mind away from what it's drilling on.
Susan says because music can fill large spaces, entire lobbies, and hallways, the musicians don't really know whom they're reaching. For Chris, music is his profession and his passion.
It's also an emotional release for me as I play or as I listen to things. And, you know, I always look up for Susan whenever we're doing a symphony concert or a band concert. I always look at Susan before I play something, or when I'm bowing to the audience, I'll always glance over at her. And that really does, it's an emotional bond between us.
After Susan's recurring cancer diagnosis, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra hosted a benefit and premiered a piece composed by Christopher Stanichar. It's called Pink Ribbon for Susan and features Chris Hill on the clarinet.
It starts out very romantically. It's a beautiful melody, and it's our sort of our romantic relationship, because as we were in the beginning of our relationship, she was diagnosed with the cancer. Then there's a sort of a battle scene, which is Susan fighting the cancer, and then it ends triumphantly because she's going to beat it. One way or another, she's going to beat it.
To me, that speaks that, you know, I have family, I have friends, I have coworkers, I have lots of people in my life, people that I've never even met that are following my story. And I think of Pink Ribbon as that. It's different instruments are playing that, and those are the different people in my life that are with me, whether I know it or not.
Well, I always tell people I pretend I don't like her. But I just think of the uplifting parts of the piece. And that keeps me focused on the good parts of what's going to happen. And so far, I haven't cried once when I'm playing it. Kind of a healing thing for us when we perform it. You know, Susan's there, makes a big difference in the way I feel as I'm performing it. And try not to think about the negative things. You know, staying positive is very important throughout this for both of us.
I would like people to listen to it and think, wow, if she can have hope, I can have hope too. And just because someone gets a stage 4 cancer diagnosis or any diagnosis, I never want to hear anyone think or say to themselves or think to themselves, that's it. Because that's not it.
The will to fight, the triumphant battle, the solitude of finding a happy place can be reached through music and writing and art. No matter what the definition of art is, it makes people feel and touches them in ways that go beyond medication. Healing the mind and the spirit impacts the body to face even the most devastating diagnosis. This is the art of healing. I'm Kara Hetland.
The Art of Healing is made possible with a grant from the Humanities Council, with special thanks to editors and producers Charles Michael Ray and Carl Gerke. Executive producer Larry Rohr and director of radio Joe Telustis. Web design by Brian Gevick.